You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. With all the stresses of life, it can be easy to lose perspective on what really matters. But Heineken believes that life is about being with friends and opening yourself to new experiences. Because when you live spontaneously and embrace the unexpected, it's a chance to create new stories and connections. You just have to open it. So enjoy a refreshingly cold, full-bodied Heineken Lager today. With its deep golden color, light fruity aroma, mild bitter taste, and a crisp, clean finish. Cheers. And now, enjoy the podcast. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. Got a real treat for you today, folks. The dude himself is coming on the show. I'm talking about Jeff Bridges. You, of course, know Jeff from movies like The Last Picture Show, Tron, Tucker, The Fabulous Baker Boys, The Fisher King, The Big Lebowski, The Contender, Seabiscuit, Iron Man, Crazy Heart, and True Grit, just to name a few. But he's also just this incredibly creative guy who's always chasing his muse wherever it leads him, whether it's photography, making music with his band The Abiders, sculpting, drawing, cartoons, writing, you name it. He's also a big philanthropist and a guy who's trying to make the world a better place, which led him to produce and narrate a really fascinating new documentary called Living in the Future's Past. And today we're going to talk about that film and how he's trying to get us to broaden our concept of the environment and climate change and understand how our energy consumption actually goes all the way back to human evolution and how it's all interconnected. He explains this idea that humans and societies make up what he calls a superorganism that's consuming at a faster and faster rate, and how maybe we can start to take some of the politics out of the climate debate and make little changes as individuals that can have this positive ripple effect. This is a deep, enlightened man who's going to really make you think today, folks. Plus, we're going to talk a bunch about Jeff's incredible movie career, what he learned from his dad, Lloyd Bridges, and how he and his brother Bo screwed around with each other on Fabulous Baker Boys, and how he and Francis Coppola basically made a student film of the movie Tucker before they even shot a foot of film. He recalls laughing it up with Robin Williams and Terry Gilliam when they were making The Fisher King, and just got a million stories about making The Last Picture Show, King Kong, Heaven's Gate, The Contender, True Grit, and also his other new movie coming out, Bad Times at the El Royale. And of course, we're going to get into The Big Lebowski and the whole fan phenomenon that sprung up around that movie, how he feels about being so identified with this now iconic character, the Dude, and why he says the Dude is really a Zen master. Plus, we cover his own Buddhist philosophy and how he keeps his perspective and always seems so happy and easygoing everywhere he goes. We talk about this sort of Renaissance life that he leads and all of these creative outlets he has. We've got all that and a whole lot more today when I talk to Jeff Bridges, coming up in just a moment. Folks, you know actor Jeff Bridges from his dozens of fantastic films, from The Last Picture Show all the way up to his Academy Award-winning turn in Crazy Heart. But he's also an accomplished musician with his band Jeff Bridges and the Abiders, an artist, photographer, sculptor, humanitarian, and producer. He recently produced and narrated an important new documentary titled Living in the Future's Past, which opens in theaters Friday, October 5th. Jeff Bridges, how you doing, man?
All right, man. How's it cooking, man?
Hey, it's great. Such a pleasure.
Good to be here.
Well, you know, I kind of listed all that stuff that you get yourself into.
Oh, man.
You're kind of a renaissance man. Art, music, photography. By the way, I'm kicking myself because I forgot to bring your book. Your photography book, Pictures, here to get you to sign
yeah.
it. But do you find that all these varied interests sort of inform each other?
They do. You know, I remember, quite a while ago, I used to get very upset with myself when I'd be, in my hotel room trying to study for a part, looking at the script, and I'd get an idea for a song or something. And I would get mad at myself. I said, you're supposed to be studying. You know? But then I'm finding that they inform each other. When I shake up my creativity, it shakes up all the stuff.
Yeah.
And it all comes, pouring out.
Have you ever taken apart, like, say, Crazy Heart or Fabulous Baker Boys, just so you can kind of double down on your music or whatever kind of interest you might have?
Well, that certainly, makes the lure more attractive when it has an element like that that I can, explore. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I have to say, with your finger in so many creative pies the way you do, somehow you're always so cool. How the hell do you keep zen when you have all that on your plate?
Well, what do? You know, it's just moment-to-moment thing, man.
Oh, yeah?
And I approach them all basically the same.
Oh, yeah?
Just kind of getting out of the way, getting out of your own way, letting the thing come through you,
Yeah, you did that great, what was the book? The Zen Master and the Dude. And I know you're a big Buddhist. So.
The Dude and the Zen Master,
And the Zen Master.
With
got
my
it
good buddy Bernie Glassman.
Yeah, yeah.
He's a Zen Master that I happened to be sitting by at a dinner party, and he leaned over to me and said, you realize in many Buddhist circles, the dude is considered a Zen master. I said, what are you talking about, man? We never talked about anything spiritual or nothing like that. He goes, oh, yeah. He says, the movie's filled with, Buddhist ideas and concepts. I said, you're kidding me. He says, well, sure, look who wrote and directed the film. The Koan brothers. You know what a koan, a Zen koan? Yeah. And then he said that there are koans sprinkled all throughout the thing. And the kind of, Bernie was all about, or is all about, bringing Buddhist thought into modern times. And he suggested that we write a book about Lebowski and how some of these Buddhist philosophies that show up in there. So we went 2 weeks up my ranch in Montana and wrote this book.
That's a good place to get Zen up in Montana. Do you spend most of your time up there?
Not most of my time, but a lot of it. We'll be heading up there in a week or so.
Yeah. Now, do you still smoke cigars? Because I don't smoke like I used to, but I always found that was a good moment of Zen.
Every once in a while, a nice cigar, man. Yeah. I go through periods where I'll smoke them more often than not. I haven't smoked them for a while, but got me cigar horny, man.
I hear you. I don't smoke them like I used to. I used to probably have one a day or something, and now it's, my doctor said, have a cigar whenever there's a special occasion, like winning the lottery.
That's right.
I was also a big fan of your dad, Lloyd Bridges. God, that guy. Comedy, drama, he did it all, didn't
I'll
he?
Say.
Did he teach you much about making movies when you were young?
Oh, he taught me all the basics, all the basics of acting. When I was, a little kid, he had that TV show called Sea Hunt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, I was on that a few times. And then we got to act as adults together twice in a movie called Tucker and a movie called Blown Away. And that was a great experience to, play with the old man again like that. That was a lot of fun.
Did you ever try to compete with each other?
No, I wouldn't say compete.
Yeah.
Now, my brother, Bo, and I,
really?
And Fabulous Baker Boys, he is, He is my, you know, my older brother by about 8 years. Do you have any brothers or sisters?
I have a younger brother by about three.
So you probably teased your younger brother, didn't you?
Yeah. But we never made a movie together.
Yeah, so Mike, Bo, and I, you know, we would tease each other.
Yeah.
Brother, but he would often, you know, get me good. And we would challenge each other in different scenes and so forth.
Yeah, so a little bit of that was real in the movie.
But it was it all in good, you know,
in
like
humor.
We would challenge, we would say, I dare you in this next take to blink prominently, blink 7 times, you know. Or you know, just stupid little things like that. Or I want you to, you know, I'll do that if you do this next take standing on 1 foot. Yeah. Just to, you know, tease each other, you know.
Did you two have much of a sibling rivalry that you could tap into for that
movie? No, we didn't. You know, he didn't have...
teasing.
Now, Bo, I think the fact that he was 8 years older, three might put a little bit more of that competition spirit. But Bo was my teacher, man, my guru, you know, and... You know, he was quite an athlete. He played with John Wooden on UCLA.
Oh, yeah.
You know, when he was
a
freshman scouted by the Dodgers. And, you know, he taught me how to box and surf and all of that stuff.
And you played football
and
too,
act
didn't
as
you?
Well. What's and, that?
I said you played football. Didn't
little
you?
Bit, a little bit, not much, much.
Well, you weren't that good. I heard you were on the A team though.
No,
right?
I don't know. Yeah, but I didn't. I wouldn't consider myself a good football player. I'm more of a surfer, and not even a good surfer.
Now you mentioned Tucker. I've always loved that movie ever since I saw it when I was young. You know, it's great because it gets the other side of the American dream. The guys who dare to dream and try, and then the world screws them somehow.
Yeah.
But you still applaud them for just getting up off their ass and trying.
Yeah, and he stuck with it. He came up with some other good inventions after that as well.
Right. What was it like working with Coppola?
Oh, it was a dream.
Yeah.
He was such a wonderful director. He did something quite unique. We had a 2-week rehearsal period on that show. And the second week... The first week was spent just getting to know each other, sitting around the table, reading some scenes. And the next week, he got all the company together, and he said, all right, now this week, we're going to shoot the entire movie, and we're only going to do each scene one time. Now, you actors, get your lines down as best you can, and, you know, you costume people... You know, you need a wedding dress. Look at these drapes. These would be good, you know. And Vittorio Storaro, our esteemed DP, he will be in this wheelchair. That'll be our dolly. And he gave this feeling like, you know, the Little Rascals, you know, our gang comedy. It was kind of, come on, let's make a movie. Let's put on a show. And he shot this whole thing. We did the whole movie in that 1 week on video cameras.
Oh, really?
In sequence.
Film.
No, on video cameras. And then what we didn't know was that to and from work, he was editing all this. So at the end of that week, he gave us the movie. He said, here now, we just have to polish it up. But this is it. And that was an invaluable thing to have because as an actor, you know, you often shoot things out of sequence. And here you can really reference the thing. And it really ingrained the story that we were telling.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So you had the movie before you actually shot the movie.
Yeah, and I found out that he even went farther back than that. He storyboarded, you know, made little like in a cartoon book of each scene, and then so that was like the movie in its entirety. And then as he made the videos, that would it replace that. And then as the real movie, that would replace that. So it always was in existence.
Yeah, that must be great for an actor because, you know, so many times you probably go on the set and director can try and explain their vision to an actor, but you don't get the full picture like you would with an experience like that.
Yeah, it was really terrific. And Francis came up with a lot of his, beautiful kind of low tech, special effects, that are so great
shots
at
in
and
that movie.
He was just playing with that too.
How old were you when you did Last Picture Show? Because that was like your big breakout movie.
Yeah, I must have been about 20 or so, 20. Something like that.
Pretty young.
Yeah.
I think you were like what?
Nominated.
The first, or the youngest guy to get nominated for Best Actor
or
whatever.
I don't know what it was, but
some record.
It was a thrill, man.
Yeah.
There.
Now, you know, when you're 20 years old and you're nominated for Best Actor and you got all that
best
fame
supporting
off of a big,
actor.
Oh, sorry,
Best
Supporting Actor.
Yeah.
Yeah. You got all that fame. That didn't go to your head at that age, or were you always able to keep it in check even back then?
Yeah. I don't remember it going to my head too much. It felt wonderful.
Yeah, I'm sure.
It's great to be acknowledged like that, you know, by your peers, by the guys who do what you do.
Yeah.
And they give you an attaboy. Oh, man, it feels great.
Yeah. The Academy has acknowledged you so many times because you're a different cat from most actors, especially the actors who came up in the 70s new wave cinema, where you had guys like De Niro, Pacino, Hoffman, all these guys who went big in terms of an emotion and high drama, that kind of thing. Whereas you're so unself-conscious, you're so unpretentious when you're in a film that I don't want to say the cliche that you make it look effortless, but you do. How do you make a role seem like such a natural extension of yourself?
Yeah, well, that's kind of the idea, not only in acting, but I think all, for me, I don't know, in all facets of movie making, it's kind of the same assignment. You know, you want it to be real, you know, you want it to be interesting. You want to look like it's happening at the first time, you know. And you can take those ideas and supply them to makeup, you know, like you want the makeup to be look real, you know. Yeah. You want it to be interesting, but you don't want it to look so interesting that it distracts from the story,
yeah,
you know.
Especially the prosthetics.
All
yeah.
of those things. And then you want it to make it look like it's no big deal. So you want to have no apparent obligation to the audience, you know.
Yeah.
No apparent. Of course you have an obligation, but you don't want to, you want to be just given the idea that you're just a fly on the wall checking it out, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, every movie that I've ever seen you in, it just seems like the audience just kind of wandered through the scene and just happened to catch
it. Thank you.
I mean, there's a certain genius to that, I think. Now, was King Kong the first big studio film that you did after Picture Show?
Oh, man, I don't have my filmography. That was, I remember the date. That was 76, you know.
Yeah.
So I remember that. But I can't remember if it was the first thing.
I remember my mom showed me that when I was young on video, and I just loved it. But those special effects have not aged well.
Oh, come
you and
on.
Jessica Lange are
oh,
fantastic.
Man. Oh, yeah.
I think the original special effects from the original King
were
Kong
better.
Aged.
Were better. No, they're much better. Oh, that's. I remember, you know, pretending to be sick so I could stay home and watch that original. You know,
yeah.
I just love that. You know, but ours was a joke. Yeah, we had so many different versions of the giant monkey. They didn't mash at all. It was crazy.
But you and Jessica were great.
Well, Jesse was terrific, and Chuck Grodin, I think they kind of had the, you know, they got the tone of the movie right.
I think that was a big film.
Yeah.
That was a big film for its day. Probably a big budget,
God,
I imagine,
oh,
too.
Oh, man. Oh, gosh.
Yeah. You know, Heaven's Gate is another one that had almost a notoriously big budget. But I think that one has aged really well at the time,
that's
though.
That's true.
Everyone's going on about this, quote-unquote, astronomical budget of $40 million.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, exactly. Yeah. And it was a kind of a mini tragedy what happened with that thing.
Yeah. But it holds up.
Mike Cimino, the director of that and the writer, I was in his first film, Thunderbolt and Lightfoot.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
with,
yeah. You
Clint,
and Clint.
With Clint Eastwood.
Great movie.
And, you know, it's interesting pairing because Clint, you know, he only likes to do one or two takes. He's kind of famous for that.
Yeah.
And, and he gave Mike the shot to direct. So I was the punk kid who kept saying, oh, I got an idea, Mike. And he said, I have to ask the boss, you know. And Clint was, I give the kid another shot, you know. And so I really was very thankful for that. And then, you know, a few years later, we were doing Heaven's Gate, and we'd be doing, you know, 50, 60 takes sometimes on, you know, trying to catch that, you know, that happy accident. But that film, as you say, I think has held up very well.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it came out at a time when everybody was used to the very fast cutting of MTV and so forth.
Right.
So it was hard to get in with the slower tempo that Cimino was creating. But I think that it's a wonderful, wonderful movie. Yeah. It's the theme of that movie kind of you know, what cynicism costs, and following Christofferson's main character. It's really something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's still one of my favorites. You know, it must be funny to look back at that movie, the fuss that they made over $40 million, you know, and then look ahead to, say, Iron Man, which he did with $200 million
That's
movie.
Right.
And they didn't even have a script from what
Can
I heard.
Can you believe that, man? Yeah. Yeah, and with Cimino, you know, I think what happened with that thing is, you know, he was the darling of Hollywood. He just did the Deer Hunter, you know, which was a remarkable film. And they said, whatever you want, kid, you know. And he said, well, I got this epic Western. And he said, okay. And so he did it. But he says, I don't want any suits on the studio, you know, at the location. No press. And I think people resented that, and you know, I think it kind of came back and bit him in the ass.
Interesting. Okay, yeah. So there was a little bit of people kind of rooting for him to fail.
Yeah, I think
on
so.
The exec side.
Yeah,
no, that's too bad. But good movie. You know, Fisher King, another great one. Robin, did you feel like you had to up your funny game when you were working with them?
No, I was a little concerned. You know, him being such a brilliant comedian. That this had some serious stuff in it, and I kept worrying about, you know, I had this one scene where he's supposed to be in a coma, you know, out unconscious, and I have this big monologue, and I kept being frightened that he would, you know, be trying to bust my chops or wink at me or something. But he was just the opposite.
Oh,
he
was
so supportive and such a wonderful, wonderful guy.
Man, what a pro.
And then on the other side, you know, talking about, you know, the comic genius, you know, you had the director.
Terry Gilliam,
who was as, you know, much of a wild kid as Robin.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes we'd be shooting late, you know, early in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, everybody's dragging. And Robin would just get up, plant his feet, and do like 10 minutes of busting everybody's chops around in the crew, you know. And most directors would then at that point say, okay, let's get back to work.
Yeah.
But Terry would just egg him on.
Oh, yeah?
And it would go on for about a half hour until we just got into this state, you know, of hilarity. And then we would, you know, have juice to continue the scenes. Yeah.
And I remember that you narrated the documentary on Terry's Don Quixote movie. What's going on with that? Aren't they finally getting that made, I think?
Yeah, man, he got it made. I haven't seen it, and I haven't talked to Terry in a long time, but I'm so happy that he got it made.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that one for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about you just the other day, watching the Brett Kavanaugh hearings. Got me thinking about The Contender. I understand that you are Obama's favorite movie president, right?
I heard that. That was very sweet. I like that. I like to think of that.
And one of my favorite lines in that was when you talk about the shark sandwich moment.
Right.
Say the president can order whatever he wants in the middle of the night. You can get a shark sandwich when you're president.
Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll return with more with Jeff Bridges when we come back in just a minute. Folks, I was really dragging this morning, and I didn't have time to wait in line for a coffee before I came into the studio, so I'll tell you what I did. I grabbed an espresso monster. That's right, the guys from Monster Energy Drinks now have a delicious creamy espresso drink in two different flavors. I tried the vanilla espresso today, and it gave me just the shot in the arm that I needed to power through my day. Espresso Monster is a premium blend of smooth espresso and cream packaged in an 8.4-ounce can, so it's just the right size and perfect for when you're on the go. Each can has 3 shots of espresso, that's right, 3 shots, blended with European milk just the way the Italians do it. And at 150 to 160 milligrams of caffeine per can, it's sure to give you the energy you need to conquer the day. Espresso Monster has 2 delicious flavors to choose from, espresso and cream, and vanilla espresso. Produced in Denmark and the Netherlands, Espresso Monster is made with freshly brewed espresso coffee, hormone-free milk, and a unique energy blend that's complete with taurine and B vitamins. Espresso Monster certainly got me going this morning, and it tastes so good, I'd drink it anyway. You gotta give it a try, folks. Close your eyes, take a sip, and enjoy Espresso Monster today. Life can be stressful, and sometimes we lose perspective on what really matters. As we rush to achieve all the things we want in life, it can be easy to forget to enjoy the smaller moments along the way. But life isn't about following a common path or having a set plan. It's about being with friends, celebrating with loved ones, and living in the moment. Heineken believes that you create the richest memories when you embrace the unexpected and open yourself to new experiences. That's why Heineken encourages everyone to live spontaneously. Because when you embrace the unexpected, things like exploring new parties, enjoying the summertime, watching exciting soccer matches, and celebrating the holidays with your family, all become chances to create new stories and connections. You just have to open it up. So enjoy a refreshingly cold, full-bodied Heineken Lager today with its deep golden color, light fruity aroma, mild bitter taste, and a crisp, clean finish. Cheers. And now, back to the podcast.
How many times do you get addressed as the dude in an average day?
Maybe once every 3 or 4 days.
Oh, really?
Like that. Yeah.
That infrequently? Because that is a crazy fan base for Lebowski.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But realistically, about like that. But, God, what a great movie that is. I'm so pleased to be a part of that.
And you seem to have embraced the whole fandom. Are you comfortable with being so identified with a particular role?
Oh, definitely. Gosh. Yeah, I've been to a couple of Lebowski fests, you know, and celebrated with folks. It's 20th anniversary. Can you believe that? 20 years, man.
Man, how time flies.
Wow.
Jeez. Yeah. Do you feel old when someone reminds you that there's an anniversary, 20-year anniversary of a movie you made? Mid-career, by the way.
I cannot believe it. It goes so fast.
Yeah. Now, you worked with the Coen brothers again not that long ago, I guess, with True Grit.
Yeah.
I was skeptical. I got to be honest with you, Jeff.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, True Grit. Yeah. I'm a fan of the Duke.
Yeah.
But you pulled it off. At the time, were you worried about, you know, stepping into John Wayne's shoes and all that? Or did you just kind of trust the Coens?
Yeah, you know, I was making a movie when they called me up and they asked me if I wanted to be in this movie they were making, True Grit. I said, you're making True Grit? Why are you doing that? You know, that's kind of a classic John Wayne movie.
Yeah,
Why are you doing that again? And they said, well, have you read the Charles Portis book? And I said, no. And they said, read the book and then we'll talk. So I read the book, and the book reads like a Coen brother movie. I mean, it really does. It's like a Coen brother script, you know.
Yeah.
And so I could see what they were talking about. Yeah. I said, okay, guys, I'm in. And once I did that, I really didn't study the Duke I wasn't too much concerned.
Yeah, you didn't want
I just
to do
jumped
an impression.
In. I just jumped in and did it. And the script was, the script was so terrific.
Yeah.
And Haley, she was wonderful to work with too.
Yeah.
Haley Steinfeld.
Yeah, it's an amazing career because you have, dozens of my favorite movies. And I understand, although I hear some of these stories are apocryphal, that there are a number of famous movie roles you turned down. Supposedly, Indiana Jones, but that's not true.
None of that's true. That got somehow on some kind of list or something, but not true.
Yeah, and so I have to confess that I went on IMDb and I was like looking at supposedly all the roles you were considered for, some of which seem strange to me, like Taxi Driver and Total Recall, Batman.
Those are all good.
Is there a movie that is the one that got away for you?
No, I remember Total Recall. Now, I haven't thought about that in a long time. And I remember that was Arnold ended up doing it.
Yeah, Arnold.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But this was a long time ago. I remember that was an interesting story. But not really. None that really, stuck in my craw.
Yeah, yeah. Not, you don't seem to get your feathers too ruffled about, even with movies that you've made, do you kind of just let it go once you're done and on to the next project?
Yeah, usually your mind is so into the thing that's currently happening. Mm-hmm. By the time the movie's coming out, there's a tension on it, but it's kind of like, you're like, you got a horse in the race, it's coming out. Come on, let's go. It's getting a couple bad. It's not. All right. it's great. And you have a chance to celebrate, every once in a while. And this is what keeps me coming back, because there's so many components to making a movie successful, mm-hmm. creatively, you know, financially, and all that.
Yeah.
But every you've got high expectations.
Yeah.
And every once in a while, it all comes together and it succeeds your expectations.
Yeah.
And that's Lebowski was like that. Stuff that's rare. Picture Show is like that. You know, mm-hmm. it's rare, but when it happens, it's really astounding. Wonderful
VR. Yeah, it seems to happen for you more than it does for most.
I've been lucky. I've been really, got a chance to work with some great folks, great stories.
Now, you've had a busy year so far. You have two movies coming out within the span of a week from each other.
Right.
You've got Bad Times at the El Royale, and then you've got this amazing documentary, Living in the Future's Past.
Yeah.
Explain what that title means, because I had to work it in my head for a while.
Yeah, Living in the Future's Past.
Yeah.
That's a metaphor for tuning in to what's already here, man. This is the future's past, where we are right now. Our movie, kind of takes a look under the hood of humanity, says, what makes us tick? Why are we responding in the way that we are responding to this situation of our planet heating up, and what is our part in that?
We tend to think that consumerism and keeping up with the Joneses and things like wanting to maximize the return on our investments are these very modern human traits. But as you find out in the movie, it seems that there are much more primal roots to those things.
That's right. That is right. And it's, how are we going to move into the future wisely? We don't always make the wise decisions, but we're certainly capable of wisdom, and we're flexible. We're a flexible species. We're nature herself, an expression of nature.
Yeah.
And one of the aspects about us is that we can reason. We can look at our past, have mm-hmm. the longer view, which is not only looking forward, but looking back and saying, what makes us tick? And you kind of, explore that, get it out in front of you, and then your wisdom increases, your choices that you make.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost a psychological therapy process, once you understand why you have these impulses and all the history behind it, and that it goes back to something way, way, way before you, this primal animalistic thing of survival and so forth. Only once you start to understand the psychology of it, can you start to alter that behavior.
That's well said, well said. And some of those aspects of ourselves really served us well in the past.
Mm-hmm.
But now, as we get into the future's past right now, we find that maybe that's not our best interest.
Yeah.
These plastic water bottles here, that we've got. They're hard to.
Now
you're thirsty. You're thirsty. Don't feel bad, but just notice, man.
A little hypocritical.
But it's tough. It's tough, man, because
it
so
is.
They're all over the place.
Yeah.
You're thirsty. You got a little plastic thing, but the they don't biodegrade.
Mm-hmm.
They say you think it would, but it just gets smaller and smaller. Fish eat it, ruins the fish. We eat the fish. It's the chain thing. There's an organization that I belong to called Plastic Pollution Coalition that's all about getting rid of single-use plastics, and water bottles are one of those.
Hey, don't blame me, man. Blame the good folks at NPR, then.
No, nobody say
bottles.
No. It's not about blame.
Or
it's
blame
just
the government. I guess you can blame the government if you want to go big picture with that, then.
Yeah, I don't know about the blaming thing. That can kind of, it's so, there's so much to blame
mm-hmm.
that I know with myself, it makes me want to just throw up my hands. I get cynical, I say, what the hell? What can I do? It's too big, man.
Yeah.
One of my heroes is a guy named Bucky Fuller, Buckminster Fuller.
Oh, yeah,
who Bucky is.
We're not on a first name basis.
He's gone anymore. He's gone now, but I like to call him Bucky. I don't think he'd mind. But he's an inventor, a scientist, philosopher, and he wrote a great book called Operating Manual for Spaceship Earth, which is a wonderful one.
Yeah.
But he made an interesting observation about oil tankers, these huge vessels. And the engineers were particularly challenged by this big rudder that had to turn the ship. And they were finding it took too much energy to turn that rudder. There was too much resistance.
Huh.
So they came up with a very simple, elegant solution of putting a little rudder on the big rudder. And that little rudder turns the big rudder, the big rudder turns the ship. And that little rudder is called a trim tab. And Bucky says, we are all trim tabs. And this is, it's a metaphor for how the individual affects society, that we can align ourselves with groups that are more powerful than ourselves or create groups that are more powerful than ourselves. We can turn that big rudder, turn the big ship. And that's what's what Bucky has on his gravestone is call me trim tab. And that's how I like to think of myself as a trim tab and you as a trim tab and everybody. We're all a bunch of trim tab.
Yeah, and I like that aspect of this film because it seems to me that so many times in environmental documentaries and the environmental community spends too much time just, you know, otherizing and demonizing capitalism and big energy, and not enough time talking about our individual participation and blame for those problems. Although we're not going to use the word blame, are we?
Well, we just have to kind of, you know,
enlarge
the context about what we're dealing with here. You know, remember like when Kennedy, you know, said in 10 years, we're putting a man on the moon. Prior to that, all of the, you know, discussion about or the disagreements about what's the fuel and the shape of the rocket, that kind of like stopped any action because there was all this argument. But as soon as you put it, we're going to do this, then all of a sudden those people are thinking opposite from you. You want those.
Yeah.
You want to encourage because we got to refine this thing.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's the deal, to enlarge this more than, you know, politics and all this, you know, this kind of thing. We got to, you know, change that.
Yeah, you know, because politics does get in the way, I think, a lot of times with environmentalism. One thing that's interesting is you have former Republican Congressman Bob Inglis on there in the film
who,
you know, talks about how he was a climate denier and now he's a champion of climate science. He says tribalism and the politicization of science often overshadows the message when it comes to environmentalism. My question is, how do we get the politics out of the conversation?
Yeah, I think, you know, bring it into the light like we're doing now, I think.
Yeah.
You know, you want those opposite opinions, but we got to think about the big picture. What are we doing here? What kind of world do we want to make?
Yeah.
How can we get there? What can we do as individuals, you know?
Yeah.
Certainly voting is a big thing.
Right.
And also, you know, you can let some of this, the fact that it isn't going in the direction you might like, you know, with the federal government and so forth. You can make a little shift inside your mind to let that inspire you to take action, man. You know, let it goose you, you know, rather than throwing up your hands and say, oh, this is too terrible.
Yeah.
No, this is, you know.
Yeah, because, I mean, is the idea that you just want to get the facts out there and the facts will win out the day? Because a lot of times it doesn't seem like that's the case these days.
Yeah, well, it's a slow thing. It doesn't move. Like this emergent behavior. Wasn't that a fascinating aspect?
Yeah.
That was something new to me, you know, this idea that like schools of fish or flocks of birds, you know, they have this, this behavior that... doesn't depend on a leader. The shape is just forming. And why is it that shape and not this shape? There's something, you know, going on. And this whole idea that, you know, you have entities that are made up of smaller entities that really don't apparently have anything to do with each other. You know, like an ant isn't an anthill. It doesn't have that behavior. But you get a bunch of ants together and boom, you get an anthill. And that's what happens with human beings and birds and fish and everything. Like we were saying, you know, some of our behavior, like this tribalism, you know, that we had, that really served us in the past. But now we've got to change that. We've got to, you know, it's not serving us now.
Right. Yeah, sure. You know, there was a time when that was a matter of survival.
That's right.
You wanted to protect your genes and so forth and procreate and keep it going and all that. But we have these weird remnants of that, you know, create all this friction that's not necessary, really. You talk about something called a superorganism, which I have to confess, that's the term I had never heard of before.
Yeah.
Tell us, what is a superorganism?
Well, you take that ant and the anthill. The anthill would be the superorganism, you know, the you know, you get you step away from the picture and you see a larger entity there that's happening, you know.
Yeah, and you say that that happens with humans, too.
That happens like, with
what
everything.
What would be an example of this big human superorganism?
Well, it's almost like, you know, as I was saying, we're not other than nature. We're nature. This is what nature does. We're living on this little, beautiful, organic globe here, and we're draining it of its materials. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got to figure out how to live on it wisely.
Yeah, yeah. And one problem we face is these unintended consequences are much costlier because of the speed with which they're happening.
Well,
we think
true.
It's just technology and life is getting faster, but also our impact on the environment is happening faster than it used to 100 years ago or 500 years ago.
Huh? As well as the climate change,
right.
You know, in correspondence to that. You know, this going back and forth that Earth is, that's happened, you know, for eons, you know, but it's happening quicker now than it is historically happened, not giving, chance for plants and animals to evolve fast enough to adapt to it.
Yeah.
And right along with this time, we're using this precious fossil fuels, these buried dinosaurs and, you know, all this carbon down there, and that's going to run out. And my wish is that we would be using that precious substance to fuel changing over to a new energy source.
Right.
And that's going to take that fossil fuel to do that, and we shouldn't be spending it so capriciously. We should focus it.
Yeah.
And I would love it if, I don't want to kick the, I would imagine putting myself in the oil guy's position. You know, nobody wants to change, man. You want the status quo. You know, but if there was some way to get all the oil guys to, be the energy folks, but switch us over, in the most intelligent way. And who knows, maybe one of these top oil guys will see our movie and say, hey,
maybe,
man.
Maybe, you never know.
Yeah, better get to work here.
Yeah, and I like that approach of, we have to preserve this resource of oil for now because, right now, solar can't take over all of our energy needs unless of course, we drastically reduce our energy needs, which is also a part of this.
It's kind of a combination of what's going to work, I was thinking like, and we're capable of doing that. Everybody hasn't stopped smoking cigarettes, but it's come to our attention that it's not a good thing. And now less and less people are doing it, right? It's just kind of a natural thing. And hopefully that kind of behavior will be evidenced in this, what we're talking about.
Yeah, yeah. So everyone can kind of do their part. Yeah, and the other thing is that we want to blame these big institutions like an oil company or something, but people don't think about how many dozen things a year or hundreds of things a year does an individual order on Amazon. And, the fact that you can go on your computer, click a button, and then that will be delivered right to your doorstep. We think of the financial cost of that. We don't think about all the other costs that go into that.
The carbon footprint. Yeah, and there's also something called a carbon handprint about things that you do in a positive way.
Oh, interesting.
That can turn,
I've never heard that
turn
term.
Things around.
Huh. Carbon handprint.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well,
that's cool. Well, speaking of carbon handprints, then, in the film, you call on people to, like you said, take ownership of their impact on the environment and make little changes in their life. And I appreciate the way you say it. You say, something that you can sustain, something that's natural to you, that, not something that you're going to do and give up after 5 weeks or something.
Yeah.
What kind of things have you changed in your life?
Well, kind of doing what I'm doing right with you, talking about it, making movies about it.
Mm-hmm.
When I go to work on a movie, I'll talk to the producer and say, can we get rid of the little plastic bottles?
Can we
have like a water manager, somebody, And I said that to this last movie, and Mary McLaughlin, the producer, said, I beat you to it. Already have. So it's already in the, in our culture to do this, to pay attention this way.
Yeah, now.
And another thing, just a small thing, but something that I'm really enjoying that I've just done recently.
Yeah.
I dig straws.
You like straws?
I like straws. Well, no. See, that's the thing. Okay. Plastic straws are banned now.
Right.
So what I'm into are pasta straws. Straws made out of pasta.
I have never heard of this.
And it's very cool. They work perfectly.
Really?
Yeah, and I really like that. So that's like another little, a little switch. Bucky, we mentioned Bucky sense. Fuller. Pasta. He always said something interesting. He says, when you want to change something, don't go right up, right up against it.
Yeah.
Come up with something that makes it obsolete.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I think, plastic straw, to a pasta straw is an example of that.
A pasta straw probably doesn't work too well in coffee or tea, though.
Surprisingly, it works pretty darn cool. Works good in my, vodka on the rocks, too.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I'll bet. Well, I loved the film, and I love that it's a departure from the usual ecological documentary in that it takes this holistic approach to the environment and how it results from and how it affects every aspect of our lives as humans on this earth. Do you think that we need to stop framing the conversation in terms of us saving the planet as if it's some altruistic endeavor acknowledge that, hey, we're part of this too. And it's as much about saving ourselves as it is about saving the planet.
Amen. Amen. And it's just natural. Mm-hmm. I say we're part of nature. Well, this is very natural behavior, what we're doing, right?
Yeah.
One of the things that we're hoping for, or we're intending to do, is to make other films like this and create a curriculum for these films and have it taught in school, all different levels of school, keep this conversation going. And, the youth, that's where the answers.
Yeah.
These guys are going to come up with some good stuff, but we got to, facilitate them doing that,
It's definitely, it has to be a generational endeavor.
Yeah.
By the way, I'm dying to see your other movie you have coming out a week after this one, Bad Times at the El Royale.
Oh, yeah.
Big Hitchcock fan here. It looks like it had a lot of that in it.
Yeah, huh? I think you might dig it there.
Can't wait.
It might be your style. It's pretty fresh. I remember reading the script and I'm pretty, I resist getting involved because I know what it means. You can't do other movies when you're doing this one, for one thing. But when I read this script, I thought, oh, yeah, we got one here. This could be cool. It's very different. You think it's going to go one way, it goes another way.
Looks like a winner.
Yeah.
Now, is the hotel in that based on, the Cal Neva?
I think it probably was.
Yeah.
I don't know for a fact, but I think it might be.
Yeah, well, I can't wait to see that as well. And this film was fantastic. Before we go, I don't know if this is a question for Jeff Bridges or the dude, or maybe a little bit of both, but you are a guy who seems to really have it figured out. Do you have a handle on the secret of life? And if so, what is it?
Well, I think that, in your sentence there, it seems to have it all figured out. Seems is the good, is the big word in caps, bold caps.
Okay.
But no, I'm just, doing my best, and I'm as, stressed out and anxious as the next guy, I'm an actor, man. I present a cool front,
Man, you sure do. Well, Living in the Future's Past opens October 5th, and Bad Times at the El Royale opens the following weekend, October 12th. Jeff Bridges, thanks so much. It's been fun.
All right, good hanging.
Keep it up, man.
Good hanging. All right.
Thanks again to the great Jeff Bridges for coming on the podcast. One more time, Living in the Future's Past opens in theaters Friday, October 5th. For more information and showtimes, visit livinginthefuturespastfilm.com. You can also keep up with Jeff at jeffbridges.com and be sure to catch his other movie, Bad Times at the El Royale, opening next week in theaters October 12th. Folks, I was just telling you earlier how I got my day started with an espresso monster today. When you need energy on the go and don't have time to wait in line, grab Espresso Monster. Espresso Monster is a premium blend of espresso and cream made with freshly brewed espresso coffee, hormone-free milk, and a unique energy blend complete with taurine and B vitamins. Each can has 3 shots of espresso and comes in vanilla espresso or espresso and cream flavors. Close your eyes, take a sip, and enjoy Espresso Monster today. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.